Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Tyler.
How are you doing today?
I'm well. And I enjoy our nonverbal exchange we have before we go on the air every week, where you look, we both breathe, we make sure we're both settled, and then we go.
It's a very eye contact heavy show.
It is very much an eye contact show. But I always wonder, what would happen if I just kept shaking my head that I'm not ready? How long would you carry on over there?
Well, the CD lasts about 2 minutes, okay. So otherwise we would go there and then dead air.
Well, there will be no dead air today, I guarantee it. I think that this topic has a lot of layers to it. So I'm looking forward to kind of diving in, seeing where it takes us.
Well, what's been on your mind this week?
Well, so it's interesting because every week when I'm coming up with our show topic, it's always a series of events or conversations or an article that my husband, you know, tears out of the New York Times for me, or just thoughts that bubble up in my head, you know, late at night, that all kind of collide together and then something comes up. And then so this week was around three different conversations that I had with parents of teenagers who were struggling with kind of the trajectory of their adolescence life. And then that kind of melded into the quarterly project that I assigned my students to have a conversation with an elder. And I make sure that I phrase it as a conversation and not an interview, because I really want my students to work on their conversation and communication skills more than anything else, that ability to overcome a little social anxiety, introduce yourself to someone, get to know them, have a conversation. And then kind of the whole sense of the holiday vibe that comes up this time of year, where a lot of people start to feel really alone, lonely, kind of thinking about their lives. And so although this is, you know, the period of time where we have celebrations and lights and good feelings and good cheer and love and hope for peace in the world, a good portion of our population really struggles at this time of year, feeling alienated, isolated, lonely, and not a part of things. And so I thought I would bring these stories and these thoughts together, and today focus on loneliness and the many layered pieces of loneliness. Because when you ask people if they ever feel lonely, you get, you know, a series of kind of similar answers. Either I love being alone, I'm never lonely. If anything, I don't get enough alone time. Or I get lonely, but not for very long, then I just find something else to do. Or people will say, I feel lonely all the time. Either just lonely in my life, even if I'm, you know, maybe someone's married and they feel lonely in their marriage, or they have that existential sense of loneliness, you know, that awakening that we have throughout different periods of life, where we realize ultimately, no matter how surrounded we are by those we love, existentially we are alone. And so that loneliness can overcome us. I mean, those are kind of the normal responses. But what we don't talk a lot about when it comes to loneliness are not just the mental health aspects of it, but the physical aspects of loneliness and how long-term chronic loneliness can really cause us to suffer. And I think the thesis for today is that a lot of the chronic loneliness that we're experiencing right now, you know, a lot has been written about the epidemic of loneliness that we have in our society, even at a time where we have more modern conveniences and more opportunities to connect. We are a lonelier culture than ever before. I think that we're missing a point in time where a lot of loneliness characteristics or a lot of loneliness behaviors emerge, and that's during the adolescent years. That this period of time, although we write a lot about it, we know very little about teenagers. You know, there's a lot of speculation, and every generation talks about that generation of teenagers or what they need or what kind of young people they are or what kind of adults they'll be. But there's really never been a period of time where we say, aha, this is teenagers and here's how we work with them. And the other thing that's interesting about teenagers is that this period of time developmentally really is just a social construct that began during the Industrial Revolution. I'm going to do a little history background because I think it's important to understand how we got to this place where we had so many brooding teens who are struggling and feeling lonely. So prior to the Industrial Revolution, when you looked at the developmental lifespan, you went from childhood to adulthood. There really was nothing in between. And so if you look at pictures, you know, from the 1800s, where the children just look like mini adults, they have the same kind of clothing on, the same stern faces. But then when with the emergence of the Industrial Revolution, the companies, the corporations, and manufacturers needed an educated workforce. They needed to have people that could run the machinery and, you know, manage workers and do more complex works than had been needed before. And so part of the development of our country was opening up this period of time for mandated public education, which meant that all young people would go to school until they graduated from what they developed was high school, until they were 18. And so this opened up, and also laws were passed, anti-sweatshop laws, that kept children from going into working in factories before the age of, I think, 12 or 14. So it opened up this period of time in the early 1900s where all of a sudden you had a lot of young people with a lot of idle time, where before they would have just been working and supporting the family. Now they were going to school, but it was seasonal school so that they could work, you know, in the family farms in the off season. They had downtime. They had time after school. So think about all the things that dominoed effect that followed this coining of the term teen. And actually it was Reader's Digest that first coined the whole term teen to describe this period of time, this whole demographic that was emerging. And so from that time period till today, we've seen the birth of drive-in movies, all of the fashion that's revolves around teens, teen magazines, teen beat, rock and roll wouldn't exist if it weren't for teenagers, you know, being around with the idle time to listen to this music and to go to dances, proms, going steady, sock hops. All of the things that evolved around teen culture have emerged very quickly, and how teenagers have found their way in society, their place in society, continues to change and morph. And so flash forward ahead to where we are today, and we have a lot of teens who struggle emotionally because they don't quite know where they fit. They don't quite have a place. And it's linked back again to this cultural shift from going from childhood to adulthood with no sort of transitional period of time where you learn the skills that are necessary to become an adult. So that's just one piece of how we got to loneliness. And this is how they're connected, that if you know many teenagers, many adolescents, you'll recognize that they go through a period of time, little death. Adolescence means little death. And it's this period of time where your childhood kind of dies away and you emerge into what your adult life will be, but you're kind of in this in-between place. And adolescents quite often can feel very negative. They feel like no one understands them. They feel like they don't have any meaningful relationships. They feel kind of out of sorts with their own family, or they don't have a friend group they feel connected with. They're also going through all of their bodily changes and their emotional changes. And so teens quite often feel unlovable, unsexy, unworthy. And those feelings that they carry, their skin might be changing, their hair feels greasy, they smell different. All of those internal feelings of negativity get projected out into the world. And as a result, a lot of teens feel like they're being pushed away from. And in reality, a lot of people distance themselves from teens because they give off this vibe or this energy of being unapproachable. And a lot of parents then spend this period of time doing one of two things. They either try to engage the teen and get them involved in the family activities or doing some sort of volunteer work or getting out of themselves in some way so they feel like they have some grounded meaningfulness in the world. Or they do, which is more common today, and I think it's where we're getting in trouble, is that parents rush in because they fear that their teenager is depressed or that they're going to commit suicide or they're going to be so dark or they're going to get into drugs and alcohol. They get so afraid of what their teen may do or may be experiencing, and they don't know how to deal with it. And so they rush in and coddle this teenager, you know, get them into counseling or give them lots of space or treat them like they're fragile. And the minute we start to treat teenagers like they're fragile or like they're broken or like they're ill, they start to take those characteristics on. Someone who's treated like they're fragile becomes fragile. Someone who is treated like they're sick becomes sick. And we've created this culture now of very fragile adolescents who have become very fragile adults. And as a result, that fragility has caused them to feel socially anxious, insecure into themselves. They haven't been kind of forced, pushed to develop communication skills or interactions, interpersonal skills, social skills. They don't know how to connect with each other. And I don't want you to quickly jump and say, well, that's because of social media. Because it's interesting, the studies they've done, and I'm going to talk about them later, but the studies they've done show that social media does contribute to loneliness. About 43% of people heavily involved in social media will report being lonely. But interestingly enough, overall in the population, those who aren't heavily involved in social media, 41% of them report feeling lonely. So social media use into itself is not really the sole reason why young people are feeling so lonely. It's more. And I think that addressing what's happening in these teen years, in these adolescent years, will be key in helping us address the epidemic of loneliness that we're feeling throughout the country. The two most lonely generations today are Generation Z, they're calling that, those 18 to 22, and the elderly, the greatest generation, who are in their 80s and 90s and are feeling very cut off. And there's also another period of time, post-retirement, for middle-aged men who had a lot of identity around their work life and their workplace and felt a lot of camaraderie or a lot of connection. When they leave that, there's a big dip in life satisfaction and loneliness can sink in and become chronic. So that's what we're going to talk about today, loneliness and the many layers of loneliness and how it impacts our life and what it is we can do to help shore up the reserves of our teenagers and to help improve the lives of the elderly and to also inoculate ourselves in some way so that we can get more joy out of our life, and especially at this time of year. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. You can be part of the conversation by joining us at 805-781-3875. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also listen to previous shows at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab or the Programs tab. And you can podcast our show if you visit Apple Podcasts or NPR One. Look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and the show will be loaded to your device every week so that you can participate. I look forward to this conversation. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be back to take your calls. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and we're talking about loneliness and what is loneliness. You know, because when I ask people if they ever feel lonely, the first thing they say is, no, I love being alone. So, you know, we have to differentiate loneliness and our enjoyment of being alone. So, Tyler, are you a lonely person?
No, I mean, my siblings are so much older than me that I was pretty much raised like an only child, and so I relish my alone time. In fact, sometimes when I'm around people too much, like we had company last weekend, and by the end of the weekend, I was like, everybody get out. I want to be...
Leave me alone.
I want to be alone. And so I don't But you and I were discussing the difference earlier. So am I alone or am I lonely? I don't know. So,
well, it's interesting because when I asked you how was your weekend, you said that it was the first time, probably since you'd been here, that you really enjoyed the Central Coast, and it was because you got out of your house and went out into the world. And so I had said to you, well, even though you enjoy being alone, it's not horrible. You did notice that you felt better when you got out and interacted with other people, which would be kind of why loneliness is a bit insidious, because we don't often identify that we're feeling it.
Well, yeah. And part of that also comes from, too, is that I'm new here.
Yes.
And I've been here a while, but also when you're an adult, it takes a longer time to make friends than when you're a kid.
Absolutely.
When you're younger, you can just be like, oh, cool, we both have the same shirt on, let's be friends.
True.
And then adulthood, it takes a little bit longer to sort of ease in and get to know people and to build up those camaraderies and stuff. So I think that was part of it. But yeah, it did help. I was around a lot of different people this weekend, and there was a lot of wine that was drank and a lot of conversations that were had.
And I'm so glad that you brought that up earlier before the show started, because it helped me kind of connect a couple of things I was grappling with, which is people quite often don't identify themselves as feeling lonely. They might say, I just feel out of sorts, or I'm just really busy. You know, I don't have enough time, or I don't have the energy. I'm too tired to get out. That if you ask people, you know, how are things going? And they'll say, I'm not really happy, or I'm not doing really well. And you say, well, what's going on? They'll list all these symptoms, right? I'm too busy. I don't have enough downtime. I don't have the energy to get out. But really, if you look below that, what they're describing is a sense of loneliness, of not feeling connected to something bigger than themselves. And what's interesting is that a good period of time alone can be refreshing. You know, that time to retreat and be with your thoughts and feel re-energized. But too much time alone can get too comfortable. And then it's hard to get up and out and re-engage in the world around you.
It really can. And I was telling you earlier, you know, it's darker now. And so I'll get off work and you can't really see as much of the city. And I would just go home and make dinner and, you know, fall asleep, get up, do the same thing over again. And you don't realize that you have isolated yourself. It wasn't intentional, but all of a sudden, you know, 2 weeks come by and I've only seen my roommate.
Yes. And so that's why I think it's important to talk about and develop awareness around loneliness, not just in our own lives, but as I started the show talking about with adolescents, with our teens, because in that period of time before, you know, we head out into the world, we're learning those skills of adulthood, how to navigate the skills of adulthood. And during that time where you're in your home, that's when you practice how to interact, how to relate. And when teens tend to pull back and get dark or moody or don't want to engage, it's really easy to just let them be, to just kind of push them away and not want to engage with them and not want to have to interact because you're busy and they're very convincing that they don't want you to be around. But the ironic thing is, even though our intuitive sense says, I'm going to give my child space. And a lot of writing, you know, about teens says, give them space, give them time to brood and kind of, you know, develop their inner sense of who they are. But really what teens need in that moment is for you to completely overwhelm them with love and attention and affection, and almost to the annoying point of, I'm here in your face, I'm not going anywhere, and you need to engage with the family. Because part of the story, as I mentioned before, that's going on with teens is that they're feeling unlovable. They're feeling like they're not worthy or part of the world, or that no one understands them. That's a common thing that teenagers will say, no one understands me. Nobody gets what's going on for me. And so they're steeped in that sense that gives off this energy of negativity and people back away. And then it's self-fulfilling to the teen. It's like, see, no one wants to be with me. But they don't recognize that their own energy, their own mood is pushing people away. And if you look at the research about people who identify as being lonely later in life, they use almost the exact same terminology. I feel like I don't belong. Cigna Health did a survey of 20,000 Americans and asked them about, you know, kind of self-identify how they're feeling. 1 in 4 said that they felt like they didn't belong in a social group. 1 in 5 said that they didn't feel like people understood them, that anyone understood what they had to say or understood what they felt. And 2 out of 5 people said that even though they're in relationships, the relationships lacked depth or meaning. So when you look at, you know, although 53% of people said that they didn't experience loneliness and felt content in their lives, you're still looking at almost half of our population, 43 to 47% of our population, feeling some level of loneliness with the same descriptors that a teenager uses when they're young. So somehow we're failing to help bridge that teenage experience into a healthy adulthood. And those teenage feelings are becoming kind of a chronic experience, I think, that lingers into adulthood. And it's not having the skills necessary to succeed. So what we need to look at, you know, is that loneliness in some ways gets ignited in our home. In our childhood, if children feel lonely, Tyler didn't feel lonely as a kid. He felt very content. But a lot of kids start to feel lonely at home. They don't feel like they're part of things. It's part of their temperament, yes. But, you know, not all introverts are lonely. And conversely, extroverts aren't actually immune to loneliness. The most outgoing people could be feeling desperately alone inside. So although temperament will play a piece in loneliness, it becomes kind of a habitual mindset. If, you know, we don't learn different coping skills, we can get caught, kind of hooked into this loneliness state. And so we need to teach starting in, you know, early childhood all the way through, teach the coping skills and tools necessary to help address what could become chronic debilitating loneliness. Because even though some loneliness is normal, it's a mood, it's a feeling, it's part of our human scale of experiences, when that feeling of loneliness is no longer fleeting or transitory and it becomes locked into our day-to-day experience, that chronic loneliness acts on us like chronic stress. Chronic loneliness can take a toll not only on our mental health, but our physical health. And when I was researching how to address loneliness, I came across an interview with our former U.S. Attorney General. His name is Vivek Murthy, and he wrote in the Harvard Business Review and many different articles in the Washington Post about this epidemic of loneliness that he was seeing and that we needed to address it as a culture. And I wanted to share with you a little bit of what Vivek Murthy had to say about loneliness in our culture. We have Vivek up there. Yeah, Vivek Murthy talking about loneliness.
Loneliness is a far bigger problem than people realize. We think because we have more technology to connect us than ever before, and because we have more people living in densely populated cities, that people are connected, that they're around people all the time. But there's a difference between being around people all the time and actually having substantial, high-quality relationships with them, where you are truly understood by another person, where you can give and receive support with someone else, where they can nourish you in the same way that you nourish them. And over time, what we have found, actually, is that since the 1980s, the levels of loneliness among adults in America has, in fact, been growing at a time where we are more technologically connected than at any point in the history of civilization. So this has been quite striking to me. What's particularly concerning about it is that loneliness is associated with serious health impacts. So loneliness, for example, is associated with reduction in your lifespan that's comparable to the reduction in lifespan that you see with smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And it's greater than the reduction in lifespan that you see with obesity. And we see that loneliness is associated with greater risk of cardiovascular disease and dementia, depression, and anxiety. And if you want to understand why, it's worth reflecting on the fact that over time, over thousands of years, in fact, we have evolved to be social beings. That doesn't mean we're all extroverts. In fact, we're a mix of introverts and extroverts, but it means that we all have some need for social connection. Because in thousands of years ago, your social connections, your ability to build trusted relationships with other people gave you a leg up when it came to having a more stable food supply or being protected from predators. And over thousands of years, that's become baked into our nervous system such that when we are experiencing a lack of social connection, insufficient social connection, it places us in a physiologic stress state. And when we are in a stress state for a prolonged period of time, then that leads to greater levels of inflammation in our body, which lead to a host of chronic illnesses, including heart disease, diabetes, cancer, obesity, and the list goes on. So this is why loneliness is so important for us to think about, because it's growing in prevalence, it has important impacts on our health, and it also has it has implications for our performance in school and in the workplace as well. There's data showing that employees who are disengaged from each other become disengaged from the workplace as well. And so, what we know is that when people are feeling isolated, when they are feeling like they are not connected with those around them, then that impacts their motivation, it impacts their creativity, and ultimately, I believe it impacts their longevity as well in the workplace. So loneliness is a really important topic. It is unfortunately something that people don't often talk about because they feel ashamed to admit that they're lonely. And there's, you know, I shared with someone recently, in fact, after this article came out, that that I myself experienced a number of years where I was quite lonely when I was a child. I was very shy. I had trouble reaching out and making friends. And I felt great about my relationship with my parents and my sister. I knew that they loved me. I loved them. I knew that they were always there for me. And I didn't feel lonely at home, but I felt lonely outside of home. And I felt ashamed to admit that to them. So to this day, I've actually not said that to my parents.
And that's Vivek Murthy, Dr. Vivek Murthy. And I hope I said it correctly. He is the former U.S. Surgeon General. For some reason, I thought I kept calling him the Attorney General, but he's the former U.S. Surgeon General under President Obama. And he's talking about loneliness and the epidemic of loneliness that he sees. The number of people who identify as being lonely has doubled since the 1980s. That's just a crazy increase, you know, and we see part of what's happening with the opioid epidemic and drug and alcohol abuse is also connected to this feeling of loneliness and isolation. So I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines and ask you, have you ever experienced loneliness? Do you feel like you're someone who struggles with feeling outside of the social realm or not connected to others or feeling like you are misunderstood or not belonging to a group that feels meaningful? Or have you overcome loneliness in your life? And then also I will throw it out there about working with adolescents and teens and how can we help them to develop social skills and coping skills and resilience so that they're able to enter into adulthood ready to deal with the complexities of life, to deal with periods of time when inevitably they're going to be disappointed or let down or discouraged or feel alone or isolated. That developing those skills early on is the best way to inoculate young people from struggling and suffering from chronic mental health issues when they get older. And I had mentioned earlier that this was inspired by a conversation with different parents and teens about what was happening. And I want to mention the stories because I think it helps highlight what we need to work on when we're launching this next generation, this Generation Z. Now, one of the parents had talked about their child having a hard time getting out of the house after graduation, had kind of stalled out, started junior college, but wasn't really, you know, doing well or feeling connected or just feeling motivated, and had dropped out of junior college and was now just at home and, you know, had a job, but just really kind of lost and not really sure where to go. And then another parent talked about their teen being very moody and isolated and feeling very kind of dark and aggressive, very angry. The parents weren't sure how to address this or to broach the conversation, that he felt very distant, talked about feeling depressed, talked about, you know, feeling unmotivated or misunderstood. And so the parents' response had been to give him lots of space, to try to not, you know, put too much burden on him or not make him feel more depressed. And unfortunately, when both of those scenarios, the parents' instinct to go to their child with love and support, in a lot of ways was setting up a long-term problem for both of these young people, that they were being set up to really struggle with long-term chronic loneliness or disappointment or social struggles. Because the child that dropped out of junior college and had a job but was still at home needs to be booted from the nest. And I know that that might feel shocking for a lot of parents to hear, but there really is benefit to booting a young person out of the nest, out of their comfort, and forcing them to fly. Even though it's the most terrifying thing for a parent, even though it is counterintuitive to what we think we should be doing, which is nurture them and protect them and keep them safe, the best thing we can do for a young person is boot them out and have them find their way. It doesn't mean that they never come home or that they're never part of the family, that you're not there to support them, but it gives them an opportunity to really experience their own abilities, because every person needs to discover their own ability to cope and to thrive. And if they're never tested, if they're never kind of thrown out there to hit the ground and have to find their way back up, then no one believes they're capable. That if we protect our children, we treat them like they're fragile, they will become fragile. But if we give our children the sense that we're confident in their abilities to thrive and survive, they will develop that. They may go kicking and screaming. They may be angry at us. They may call and say, you're the worst parents ever, and why did you do this, and how did you send me out here? But in the long term, they will be better, stronger humans. And it's interesting because a lot of parents, myself included, why would we ever want our children to think we're the worst parents ever or be angry at us for making choices or decisions that make our children's lives more difficult? But we have to remember that it's not our job to be our children's friend. It's not our job to be well-liked by our children. Our job is to prepare our children to be adults and to be able to function away from us, because we won't always be there and they'll have to go out and make their way in the world. So one scenario of booting our kids out of the nest is a great way of pushing them away from potential loneliness into thriving. And it doesn't have to be just out into the streets, here's your luggage, you go, but into some sort of programs. And that brings me to the third conversation with the parent whose child was struggling and not finding his way and feeling depressed and, you know, went to counseling, but the counselor just wanted to do medications instantly. He's depressed. We got to get him medicated. And the child's like, I don't want to do this. I just need to do something else. I don't know how I'm going to survive. And he went off and entered into an outdoor program that changed his life, that turned his life around. And we hear countless stories of young people who go off and do a service year, or they go out and do an Outward Bound, or they go out and do some sort of journey to every national park, or they take a job working in a national park for a season. You know, having some sort of program that they go to that's away from home, but it's structured, it's challenging, it forces them to make choices and decisions on their own that might be overwhelming. But in the long run, it gives them those skills to trust themselves, which will help them in turn develop the skills in interacting and being social with others. So what do you think about that? What do you think about the idea of booting our youngsters out of the nest and forcing them to fly a bit unattended to, so they can develop the skills necessary so that they don't shrink backwards and become too dependent on their home or start believing their own internal story that they're fragile or broken or ill? I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. You're invited to be part of the conversation as we continue on talking about loneliness. We're going to take a break and come back and take your calls.
I'm looking for that lonely street. I've got a sad tale to tell. I need a place to go and weep. Where's this place called Lonely Street? A place where there's just loneliness, where dim lights bring forgetfulness, where broken dreams and men
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and that's Patsy Cline singing about Lonely Street. And we're talking about loneliness today and all the many layers of loneliness that we experience. We can have transitory loneliness when we move to a new place or we start a new job or we end up, you know, in a new situation. We can also experience chronic loneliness if we feel isolated from a community or we have a hard time connecting to others, we feel misunderstood. And where does loneliness come from? How does it develop? As I mentioned before, there's a small part of it that maybe our temperament. Some people are more prone to being lonely than others. But really, introverts and extroverts get lonely in the same degrees. Neither one is more prone. But a lot of loneliness is a learned habit. It's a learned response to what's going on in your life. And how can we then help address loneliness before it becomes chronic in young people? And how do we deal with loneliness when we're feeling it as adults? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation today. Hi, Amy. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Elizabeth. I was just thinking a lot about this because one of my kids just went off to college and living in the dorm situation. And I think naturally, we think, oh, lots of friends, lots of new relationships, and fun. But I think for a lot of kids, that can actually be very lonely. And I know it is a little bit for him. And also, I believe my daughter had the same experience when she went off to college. And she had never really, neither of them had really felt that way before growing up in a small community where they knew everyone. So I don't know if other people have had the same experience or that's pretty common.
I think it is common. And Amy, I'm glad you brought it up because, you know, here we have Cal Poly with 15,000 students. And I hear more often as an instructor that students are feeling lonely, don't quite know where they fit in, can't quite find their group. And even though there's a lot of opportunities, clubs on campus and the week of orientation, I think part of the struggle, and it has changed from when you and I were young to today, you know, the same opportunities for connection are there, but because students are coming into school with less social skills, they're having a harder time making those connections. That we really have stopped pressing and teaching how to make friends, how to interact, how to start a conversation, which I think is setting young people up a lot for feeling very alone in college.
Right. I definitely gave my son recently some suggestions, and then listening to you, I'm like, maybe I gave him too many suggestions. Maybe he needs to figure out that on his own. I don't know.
Well, and I think it's tough because you're saying what a lot of parents of this generation are feeling is that, you know, I want to give my children all of the tools they need to thrive. Unfortunately, some of the tools we're offering are keeping them more kind of connected to us, their family, and not kind of forcing them to find their way. And, you know, one of the things I say to my students, and it may not be popular and feel free to disagree, but I say, I really encourage you to not call home every day, to talk to your parents maybe once a week, because that lifeline to home every single day prevents you from having to address the loneliness that's going to encourage you to go out and make friends.
Right. Yeah, we had a rule of you can't come home until Thanksgiving, so you gotta hunker down over there.
Yes. But before, when, you know, you and I were young, we couldn't talk to our parents every day. We didn't have cell phones and it was too expensive. But I think we're missing a really key piece that's preventing students or young people from breaking, you know, out, is that they can call or text us 24/7. And that, I think that becomes a little too much of an enabler, to use a therapy term.
A crutch. That's a good point.
Yeah. Thank you, Amy, for bringing that up, because I think it touches a lot of people. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And Anne, you're on the phone. What's on your mind?
I didn't hear everything that was spoken with the previous caller, but I think it might be kind of along the same line. I had a friend in school. She had a brother that was a year older. They were both kind of, you know, non-party, stay-at-home. He was a little bit overweight, and he wasn't, you know, socially comfortable, so he had one friend, and he didn't really go out that much. You know, she pretty much, you know, stayed home. We were both into horses, and she had a horse, and so that was that. But when it was time to go to college, she, you know, went to community college, and when it was time for her to go to a real college, mm-hmm. she took off. She became a vet. She was great. But he spent a year up in Santa Cruz. I helped, you know, deliver him. I thought it was a beautiful campus. But at the end of the year, he begged to come home, And his mom, you know, said, sure, he came home and he never left. And years later, she said that was her big regret, that she hadn't pushed him to, you know, go back to school and to try to make it out there. And he never left. He's, you know, his parents have passed, but he's still in the same home. And, you know, he's never left.
And so, I think that is a challenge, isn't it? Because as parents, we want to lead with our heart. We want our children to feel safe and loved and accepted. But that intuitive love can oftentimes be the deterrent for our children finding their own way.
Yeah. I was, I was really surprised at how much, you know, I could see, you know, my friend being a little bit more clingy maybe at home, but no, she was fine. And, you know, she knew what she wanted and she was ready to go out, but he just never. And I was really, you know, kind of amazed at how much he stuck at home and how much he played it safe.
Yeah. And it'd be interesting to have a conversation with him to find out, you know, does he feel lonely or has this life been satisfying to him? Because that's another part of the conversation. If he never really felt that he missed out on anything, then maybe, you know, he just got settled into this. But my guess would be that there's a lot of angst and depression and sadness that goes into that isolating.
Yeah, I think, like, I still have contact with him from time to time. And I, you know, like, there was a time when he would call me. I have to say that when back in junior high and high school, his and my relationship were a little antagonistic. You know, he could piss me off, and I would really get mad at him. And so we weren't, like, close. But, you know, and I've never... you know, I at Christmas I'll give him a present and you know I'll talk to him, but I never felt that we were really that close. But then we went through a period where he called me like two or three times a day, mm-hmm. and so I really think that maybe he doesn't have, you know, a close connection.
Yeah, and as Tyler was saying earlier, when we become adults, it becomes more and more difficult to make those friendships because we are more isolated from the day to day with other people. So,
and I thought it was the Central Coast. I grew up in LA, and I had friends that I could just call and say, "Hey, let's go do this," or "I've got to do this," and you know, "I've got to run these errands. You got some errands to run? Let's go do it." Up here, it seems a lot more isolated. I don't have anybody that I can just call and say, "Hey, let's go do this." Everyone's got a more structured life, and it could be because we're older and we believe in doing things a certain way, or we have certain things that we do. But it doesn't seem as easy as it used to be to just kind of say, "Hey," you know, like if someone says, "Oh, I've got to go and put up my Christmas decorations," you know, I feel like if I said, "Oh, hey, can I come and help you?" They'd say, "Oh, no, I know what I'm going to do. I can do it by myself. You know, it's okay, but thank you." You know, whereas when you're younger, people say, "Yeah, sure, come on, let's go." I don't know.
Well,
age
makes a difference, and I think there's the cultural piece also. Anne, thank you for calling. There is that shift in our cultural attitudes that people feel busier than they've ever felt in their lives. Life is moving at a really fast pace, and so we kind of crave that downtime where we can just kind of retreat and go into ourselves. But then when does that downtime or that retreating or that alone become chronic, and then it becomes loneliness, but we don't recognize that we're lonely because it sneaks up on us. All of a sudden we start not feeling as energetic about life, or we realize we don't have, you know, someone to call, or we realize it's been days since we've actually gotten out of our pajamas. And that's when you can start turning around and recognizing, oh, there's something missing. And unfortunately, we quickly jump on those symptoms as depression, as signs of depression and some biological sickness. But really, if you backtracked out, you'd see that a lot of sadness, overwhelm, depression that people are experiencing kind of starts slowly as this period of retreat or pulling back from relationships that becomes too comfortable and chronic because it's an effort to get out. And there was a book that was written years back called Bowling Alone, and it talked about how we shifted as a society from being social, having bowling leagues, going to play bridge, having, you know, social engagements outside of the house, that couples belong to different clubs, they did things socially together. And since that time, we've struggled more in our relationships. You know, the more that we've hunker down at home with Netflix and, you know, video games and this kind of self entertainment, we've become more unhappy, more lonely, more anxious, more depressed, and our marriages struggle for it. Our relationships struggle for it. Because if you're depending every day on your significant other to keep you entertained, that's a lot of burden on just two people. And so one of the survey results from the Cigna survey on mental loneliness talked about 2 in 5 people in relationships said that their relationship quite often felt lonely and empty. It takes work to keep relationships thriving. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. What do you make of this chronic epidemic of loneliness? Is it something you recognize or relate to? And do you see it starting at home? How do we engage with our teenagers, our adolescents, during a period of time where they are dark and moody and brooding and challenging to be around? How do we grab them out of this space and get them engaged in the world and teach them the skills of communication and socializing so that they're ready as adults to take on those challenges? I want to talk about some of the steps towards addressing loneliness. And the first one, the very first step, is to accept that loneliness can be an inherent part of life. That we can feel lonely, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we're mentally ill or depressed or, a hermit or unworthy of love. Loneliness can be kind of a transient experience, a period of time that we go through, a period of reflection and insight. But it also, loneliness can be that grist, you know, that sand in our shoe that motivates us to make some change, to reach out, to develop new relationships. But in order to do that, we have to look at step 2 for addressing loneliness, and that is developing coping skills by improving our social skills. And how do we improve our social skills? Practice, practice, practice. You know, social anxiety is one of the most common diagnoses that young people receive today. That's a whole nother show. I have a lot of feelings about this diagnosis of social anxiety, but let's just say that when you tell someone that they're struggling, they will struggle. And when you tell someone that they have social anxiety, then they stop practicing being social, because being social is a skill. And we all have different levels of anxiety about it. It's not as bad as speaking in public, which can be debilitating for people. But having to go out and start conversations is never comfortable. That's why I assign this to my students, to go out and have a conversation with an elder, because a lot of them don't even know how to strike up a conversation. How do you do that? Well, you look for something you have in common. You see someone that has a shirt with an interesting saying, you know, and you walk up and say, "Hey, I love your shirt. Where'd you get that?" Or you notice that they're walking their dog. Dogs are great conversations starters. Or they're drinking a latte or a coffee. Say, "What did you choose today?" You know, today I was in the Food for Less in Aurora Grande buying cat food, and I was lamenting to this couple that walked up next to me, and we were all staring at the cat food for a long time. And I said, "Isn't it strange and sad that our cats get so picky about their food? I spend more time, you know, trying to decide what to buy for my cat to eat than I think about my own family." And they laughed, and we talked about our cats. And it was just a random 30-second conversation, but I left feeling a little better. I left feeling a little light, and I'd had a laugh with strangers. And so we have to develop those social skills by practicing them, by learning how to start a conversation. That's why our dinners at home with our families are so important, because that's where we practice those conversation-starting skills, bringing a topic to the table, opening up. The next is our communication skills. How do we carry on a conversation? A lot of people wonder why they have a hard time connecting to others, and it might be because they spend too much time talking about themselves and not enough time engaging or interacting with others, asking them questions, being curious about who they are. So communication starts with listening to what's being said to us. And the second piece of communication is having self-awareness. Are your communication skills engaging other people to respond and interact with you? Or do you notice that people end conversation quickly and move away? That can be an indication that you need to work on those communication skills, develop interesting things to say, develop a capacity to listen more and talk less, and move towards things that make you a little uncomfortable. You know, sign up for a class or an event that you're interested in and actually show up. Actually get out of that comfort zone and go. The other piece to address loneliness is finding balance in our daily activities. And I know what you're saying, and I can see, you know, rolling your eyes, that everything in life takes so much effort. It's so much easier just to put on my pajamas and turn on Netflix and just zone out or play video games. You know, even though I feel lonely and my health is declining, it's way more effort to have to, you know, get out and do something or work on myself every day. And that is your choice. You can choose to be whatever state you want to be. But if you want to address the loneliness and enhance the quality of your life, and therefore maybe model for your children a more healthy, productive way to live, then we work on balancing our daily activities. And it's funny because you wouldn't think this would be on the list of balancing our daily activities to combat loneliness, but sleep is number one. Because it'd be funny when you're sleeping, you're by yourself, but maybe you're having fabulous dreams. And so you're not alone in your dream state, but sleep helps us reset, helps to stabilize our central nervous system, helps to calm, you know, our bodies, helps us get a fresh perspective. So sleep is the first thing that we need to work on. And sleep is the thing I think most people are challenged with. The second one is spending time with family. And it's interesting that the holidays are here and we talk about it every year and we think about it a lot, is that some of our most challenging relationships can be with our family. And it can get really easy to just write family off as being annoying or too hard to spend time with or not being on the same page politically or socially as you. And so you just hibernate or you cancel going to events or you shorten the amount of time you spend together. And although that feels easy, the easier way to deal with family, it's not really in our best interest. It's not what helps us to thrive. Even a heated conversation with a family member is better really for us overall than being isolated and stewing in our anger or annoyance with our family at home alone. The next one is physical activity, getting out there and getting a walk, grab a friend. As Anne was saying earlier, you know, it's important to kind of engage with those in your community. If you're going to go for a walk, drag a friend, have a conversation, go for a swim, have some sort of, you know, activity that gets your heart pumping, but also puts you in touch with others. Take a group class. And then this one, to kind of wrap things up, is what Vivek Murthy talked about, the former U.S. Surgeon General, that was most surprising to me, and I think might be surprising to you, is that we can do a lot of work around loneliness by addressing what goes on in the workplace. That for a lot of people, their work life is the most isolating and lonely experience they have. That over the last 50 years, people have reported higher incidence of dissatisfaction with their work. 68% of people surveyed said they're dissatisfied and bored and uninspired by the work that they do. And how we work now has become less social. People work from home or they work in cubicles or they're isolated from other people. There isn't the contact. And the other part is that so many workplaces don't inspire any sort of camaraderie or contact. There aren't as many teams that come out, you know, the workplace softball team or the workplace bowling league or the workplace, I don't know what else, bridge club, but there used to be a lot of social built into the workplace. And how about the loss of parties? What happened to Christmas parties and social events where it brought people together to have conversations? People are spending the majority of their life at work, and yet they feel lonely and isolated at work. And so employers could do a lot for the mental health and physical health of their employees by actually creating a workplace that inspired this sense of connection between workers, that people would look forward to coming there. They would have a friend that they have lunch with or have a book club with, you know, have some sort of activities that are workplace based. Those would go a long way to addressing what we're seeing in the physical decline of people in their lives. Because remember, it's not just a mental health issue. Loneliness is not just about feeling sad or increased sense of anxiety or increased sense of depression. Loneliness is also connected to our physical health. That chronic stress can attribute to heart disease, to obesity, to early onset of dementia and Alzheimer's, that this loneliness can be something that eats away at us in ways that we don't even recognize. So I guess that's the challenge, isn't it? To find that balance in our life between connectedness to others and time to be alone. But I think loneliness really starts with how we work with adolescents, with our teenagers, with this period of time that's kind of been this undefined, you know, social construct of young people who aren't kids anymore but aren't really adults, and what do we do with them? And if they sit and stew and brood in all the ways that they don't fit in, they feel like outcasts, they don't have a place, then that's going to set them up for a lifetime of feeling lonely and feeling out of place. And so as parents, if your child is struggling, instead of protecting them and telling them that they're fragile or sending them to therapy and getting involved in all of their activities and trying to protect them from feeling sad, it might be time to send them out. Send them on a hero's journey. Get them involved in a program. Get them out of the comfort of the house. One of the most inspiring books I ever read was Henderson the Rain King. And the whole story of Henderson was how he, you know, had to get out into the world and experience himself outside of his family. And when he returned home, he realized that he had everything he needed here, but he would never be satisfied with it if he didn't go out and challenge himself in the world. So I challenge you over the holidays to force your teen to be more engaged. Give them assignments, give them jobs, have them wrap the gifts or be part of the gift giving circles, or have them be in charge of cooking a meal. Engage them in creating a game night. If they start to be grumpy and want to go to their room, pull them back in. Because when you model that connectedness, although your teen will pretend like they hate it, and maybe inside they are hating it, down the road, they will look back on that and say, I'm so glad you didn't push me away, because even though I was feeling unlovable, you kept me involved. And so this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Please continue this conversation on my Facebook page or on our Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. I'd love to hear your comments and feedback. Start a conversation there. You can send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And as always, I look forward to continuing this conversation next Tuesday. And I thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Beside me in your way.